Tested is sponsored by Hungry Harvest, offering farm-fresh produce delivered to your door starting at $15. Shop now with code WUNC. Every delivery supports local hunger-solving organizations. Find more at hungryharvest.net.
I'm Leonida Inge. This is Test It from WUNC, a look at what the day's challenges tell us about where we are, what we believe, and who we want to be in North Carolina and the South. Today, who counts? You could hear the beat bumping for blocks around St. Augustine's University in East Raleigh on a recent fall afternoon. The music was meant to get folks hyped about something that only comes around every 10 years, the census. But even though I was tempted to stay by the speakers and enjoy the tunes, something caught my attention, or you could say caught my eye. A new mural was painted on a brick wall outside a shopping center. A huge eye, the kind that you see with, was right in the center.
The mural says, I count, really big. And for me, that's what it means for me. Like, I count, I exist.
Lord Fly grew up on the south side of Raleigh. He says he's not an artist, he's a messenger. And he has one message for his community with this year's census. Get counted.
So that's what it represents. I was able to do something to get people to understand that we count. And if we stand up, stand out, show up, show out, and give that undeniable energy that I know lives within all of us, we can make the change that we want to see happen. So that's what I'm a figure for, a messenger for.
As Lord Fly proudly stood beside his mural, food trucks fired up their grills and census workers set up shop, ready to help folks with questions about this year's count. Actually, Wake County has one of the highest census response rates in the state. But in this particular neighborhood, zip code 27610 in East Raleigh, the census response rate is one of the lowest in the area. Communities of color have been labeled as, quote, harder to count for a long time. We'll get into why that's been the case historically in just a minute. But more recently, it could come from less access to the internet, different family structures, our language barriers. And 2020 census is showing signs of the same trend. According to the Urban Institute, people who identify as Black or Hispanic could be undercounted nationally by nearly 4%.
So right now it is all hands on deck.
Stacey Carlis is the executive director of the NC Counts Coalition. It's her job to get the most accurate census count possible. That means coordinating efforts between government officials, nonprofits, and many other groups.
It's about 150 nonprofit organizations total that we're working with who are on the ground and who are getting out the count however they can. So as of right now, from the governor's office, we've been informed it's about 3 to 3.5 million more people that need to be counted. So that's a lot of people. You know, it's federal dollars. That's $1,800 per person. So, and then you take that and you multiply it by 10 years. So again, even if we're just looking at the financial impact, it's a lot of money that we could be leaving on the table.
North Carolina has one of the lowest self-response census rates in the South, a little over 62%. Nationally, the state ranks 37th, nothing to brag about. Organizations like NC Counts are working overtime to try and get census information from 400,000 more North Carolina households by the deadline.
So we're in the middle of COVID. For example, in Raleigh, we know that 27610, that's where the most COVID cases are. That's also where our Black and brown communities are located. So not only do we go out and talk about census, but we provide them with PPE, we give them the face masks, we give them the hand sanitizer, and we make sure that they're protecting themselves and their families as well. So we're trying to build onto other events that are happening because we don't want people to lose sight of the importance of the census.
Getting this count right is important for many reasons. Like Carlis says, a more accurate count means more federal dollars and government resources for the community. It can also mean more political power. The census influences how many representatives each state gets in Congress. But Carla says all this is often lost on people.
Unfortunately, no. A lot of times they don't know what is actually at stake. Like, really, the misconception is, why is the government in my business? And then even after you take it a step further and explain to people, this is what it's actually going to do, because of the history of this country, there's a lot of skepticism. Like, I don't believe that's really going to happen. Just like how sometimes you have to sway people to register to vote and actually vote, it's the exact same thing with the census.
Getting an accurate count is key. But that skepticism Carlos mentioned, well, there's some historical precedence for that. Today, people have lots of control over how their information is filled out, but that certainly wasn't always the case.
The census was involved in creating race as much as it was by counting by it.
Melissa Nobles is a dean and a political science professor at MIT. She's researched the history of racial categories with the census. Recently, if you filled out the census, you've been able to check multiple boxes for race. But Nobles says things looked a lot different back when the census started in 1790.
The issue is really one of civil status. That is, were you free or were you slave? So the only free people were citizens, and also free people were white people. It also asked about Indians and slaves. And by the 1840s, that begins to change, and where you begin to see what might be regarded as color or race as opposed to civil status. So 1840 is, you begin to see the new categories. And then, of course, 1850, you have the introduction of the mulatto category, which in my mind is one of the more important periods, at least in the 19th century, because it is the introduction of racial science. And they were trying to build a science, at least in the 19th century. And they used the categories and had theories about it, which explains why, for example, the mulatto category stays on the census until 1930.
With this history lesson, we have to almost jump to the 1960s. You know, when I think of the job of the enumerators, you know, actually their purpose, and I guess there was some discrimination there.
So one of the interesting things that happens in the 1960s, and up until that point, census data had been largely used, although not exclusively, to really reinforce the categories by law that existed in the South. Meaning, if you were by law in the South and by custom in the rest of the country, that if you had any known African ancestry, a Black ancestry, quote unquote, you were Black, right? So that was pretty much inscribed in the instructions of the Census Bureau. And so up until the time of the 60s, enumerators were effectively would, you know, look at you and I kind of make a determination about, you know, which categories you fit in. But by the 1960s, that changes, and in part having to do with the general change in the country and notions of governance, that state institutions will become more responsive to their populations, right? There was a movement to think about democratizing census taking and allowing for more citizen participation. And that revealed itself in allowing people to self-identify. So no longer relying on numerators for that, making those judgments and substituting their judgments for the citizens, and rather the citizens themselves making the determination.
And I know it would in the 1980s, Hispanic was added.
Correct. And as a separate category as opposed to race, in part because the notion is that Hispanics could be of different races, Black or white. So you have a are you Hispanic? Yes, no. And if not, do you write your race? But of course, it's been quite challenging in a way for Hispanics because many don't see that category may not make a lot of sense to them, at least initially. They think about their country of origin, assuming that they are recent immigrants or their parents such. And so they may have a hyphenated identity. I'm Honduran American. I'm Colombian American. I may not necessarily see myself as Hispanic. But of course, that term begins to make better sense in the U.S. in our political lexicon. When you're here living in the U.S. for a while, in the way U.S. politics kind of is organized, socially at least, you know, we have groups. We have African-Americans, Hispanics, which is now Latinx. And so people see it as a useful strategy to organize around, even if it still doesn't pertain to their personal identity. So they may say, I know that I'm viewed as part of the Latinx community, for example, but my own personal identity may be Cuban-American or Puerto Rican or whatever.
few years after that, people of African descent, you know, could actually be more specific about their race and their culture. Because I think we all remember when President Barack Obama filled out his census form.
Yes.
And how it was such a big deal when he marked African American, Black.
Right, exactly. And now we have, exactly, with many more African immigrants coming to the country. They may not see their self-identity as Black in the way that is understood in the U.S., but rather think about their country of origin. I'm Nigerian American, a Senegalese American, or the like. And so I think all those things are important. It just reveals kind of, A, this is as much a political and social process as it is a purely demographic one. So the notion that the census would be somehow outside of politics or outside of society makes no sense, right? The point of it is, it in fact reflects our changing sensibilities about these things. And so we've seen that in the past 20 years. So in 2000 was the first census which allowed Americans to choose more than one category. So in keeping with our earlier thinking, particularly one that reigned for most of the 20th century, all of the 20th century, the notion was that you could only have one identity, right? And in certain ways, that's kind of rooted in the categories of white and Black, which continue to anchor our understanding. So generally, you know, the thing would be whites are pure, quote unquote, because anyone, if you had a ancestor who was white and Black, you were Black. If you had an ancestor who was white and Indian, you were Indian, right? So the only category seemingly, now that's completely a political and social fiction, right? It makes sense within our history, but there is no, you know, kind of other meaning for it. So we get to the 21st century and citizens say, actually, I want to choose all of my ancestry. I'm going to do it, and I'm going to, and I want the census to allow me to do that. So I want the categories to look more like what I think I am, as opposed to what history and our politics would dictate.
What's the most important thing folks should remember, especially for this count? And when you talked about the count and politics, and we know how important our political figures have said, you know, an accurate count, how important it is, you know, what's going to become of this count?
The main thing about the census, the racial categorization aside for a moment, the census itself is an incredibly important instrument for government to do good, in part because we want policies that are based upon accurate data. And one of the more important functions of the census has been the basic issue of representation, right? It's important also to know how the citizens are understanding those identities and how they categorize themselves. So it's important to know that too. So I think to be seen and to be counted is extremely important. I encourage everyone, if they haven't already done it, to fill out their census form.
Back in Raleigh, North Carolina, Stacy Carlos with NC Counts says she knows people might be hesitant to fill out the form, but taking 10 minutes to do it will go a long way in the next 10 years.
We're busting myths. So any myth that, you know, you're not supposed to take the census, or why is the government all up in my business, educating people on why it's important, making sure people know that this is private, confidential, protected by federal law, and that this is actually going to bring back resources to their community for the next 10 years.
The deadline for the census remains up in the air. A federal judge ruled this week that the national count can continue through the end of October, giving folks one more month. The Trump administration says it plans to appeal the decision. For now, the North Carolina Census Office encourages everybody to make sure they're counted by the end of September.
Hey, I'm Russ Henry. I work with Leonita here at WUNC. Hope you're enjoying this episode. I'll let you get back to it, but I need just a minute to tell you about some other shows from WUNC you may like. Our politics podcast is basically required listening as we get closer and closer to the huge election day in our state. Capitol reporter Jeff Tiberi is all over the issues, the elected officials, and the news that's driving debate and policy in North Carolina. And speaking of news, the State of Things podcast features conversations with newsmakers, journalists, artists, activists, and others who are influencing the culture of North Carolina every single day. Hosts Frank Stacio and Anita Rao offer a kind of up-close look at our state you won't get anywhere else. Check out the WUNC Politics podcast and the State of Things podcast right here on this app you're listening to. And be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode of these shows.
America lost another giant in past days, even though she was only about 5 feet tall. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg was a towering figure for women's rights, civil rights, LGBTQ rights, everybody's rights. Her time on the High Court was monumental, and now in passing, she continues to make history as the first woman and Jewish person to lie in state at the U.S. Capitol. But over the years, Ginsburg became a cultural icon, known as much for her presence off the bench as on it. Little girls who look like they can barely read a Dr. Seuss book, let alone a Supreme Court brief, have been photographed wearing a black robe like Ginsburg, and of course, a robe with a lace collar. Her signature collar and what it stood for echoes the lessons Ginsburg learned from her mother, who died when the justice was a senior in high school. Ginsburg once said, "My mother told me two things constantly. One was to be a lady, and the other was to be independent." Ginsburg showed off and explained two of her neck pieces on CNN in 2018.
Oh, this one was given to me by the University of Hawaii with French lace, and the beads are from the beach. And this is what I use for announcing majority opinion. And this one is for dissenting opinion.
Today, you can buy buttons and other memorabilia with images of Ginsburg's, quote, dissent. I think of all of the other dynamic women who successfully fought for their rightful place in our nation's capital and who have left strong, stylish impressions on me. There was former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, known for her beautiful brooches. She even wrote about them in the book, Read My Pens, Stories from a Diplomat's Jewel Box. And these were no ordinary pens, as she told NPR's Susan Stamberg back in 2009.
Well, I'll tell you why we are, because I use them as a tool of diplomacy. Well,
you
I'll
stick
tell you,
people with them, you put the unclasped pen.
No, but I tell you, this all started when I was ambassador at the United Nations. Saddam Hussein called me a serpent, and I had this wonderful antique snake pin. And so when we were dealing with Iraq, I wore the snake pin. So I thought, well, this is fun. So then I went out and I bought a bunch of costume jewelry to signal what my mood of the day was.
Wow. You know who else had undeniable individual style, especially when she ran for president of the United States in 1972? The late Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm. This African-American woman broke all kinds of barriers with grace, finesse, oh yes. She had to hold her head up high and strut because attacks were coming from all directions, like when she opposed the military draft. I recently read that Chisholm never wore pants, swapping them out for bright suits with skirts she had ordered and lots of pearls. And let's not forget the cat-eye glasses. Chisholm wasn't afraid to wear her femininity, whether it was around her neck like Ginsburg or on her left lapel like Albright.
I am the only unbought and unbossed politician, and I mean that literally. And I think that you have to recognize that because I am not white and because I'm not a male, that I am not going to get the blessings of the power structure in this country.
Just like women wore white in the suffrage movement, these women stood out in a sea of DC dark suits. Being a woman on the Hill was their secret weapon, and women and men of all ages and colors are better for it. One would say the most popular woman in Washington, DC right now is Senator Kamala Harris, the Democratic nominee for Vice President of the United States. Let's see how far her Converse All-Star tennis shoes will take her. That's it for this episode of Tested. I'm Leonida Inge. Charlie Shelton Ormond is our producer. Lindsay Foster Thomas is the executive producer. Thanks for listening.